Welcome to EIR Talks. This week we present the LaRouche Connection, an audio-video news magazine produced by Executive Intelligence Review, which was founded in 1974 by Lyndon H. LaRouche.
Welcome to the LaRouche Connection. It's Monday, May 29th, 2001. This is Tony Papert. Our recent shows have featured heavily the Schwalbach, Germany conference this May 4th through 6th, organized by Lyndon LaRouche and his associates, which featured delegations from 40 countries. As you may know from those shows, a key focus of that conference was the Eurasian Land Bridge Project. This is a project for world economic recovery, pioneered by Lyndon LaRouche from the period beginning the early 1990s. What it does is link the world center of industry and high technology in Western Europe with the world centers of population in South Asia, East Asia, including China, and Southeast Asia, not just through transportation corridors as such, but actually development corridors, 100-kilometer-wide corridors featuring transportation, communication, pipelines as seeds for industrial development in those corridors, crossing the low, among other things, the low population areas, the vast plains and deserts of Central Asia. Now, since that conference took place, May 4th through 6th, there have been a series of groundbreaking developments toward that Eurasian land bridge project. On May 15th, the Russian Minister of Transportation, Sergei Frank, announced the formation of a Eurasian Transport Union as a world association of governments, industrial corporations, and organizations dedicated to achievement of Eurasian transport corridor routes. And in fact, the transport corridor routes, which Minister Frank featured in that presentation, were ones which the Lyndon LaRouche organization worldwide has been pointing to in widely circulated reports, like its Eurasian Land Bridge report, which has been widely circulated since 1997. Then on May 24th, China's President Jiang Zemin, speaking to the Asian-European meeting, an annual meeting of leaders of Europe and Asia, emphasized again China's call for a new Silk Road, linking what he said were the ancient centers of civilization of Asia and Europe. And on the same day, Chinese Prime Minister Zhu Rongji discussed the China's project for a 1,200-kilometer railroad linking Beijing and Shanghai, the two major cities. The Prime Minister said that if the current project for a magnetically levitated train using the German Transrapid system between Shanghai and its airport is successful by around the date of completion, which is 2003, China would consider similarly using high-speed magnetically levitated rail, the German Transrapid system, for the 1,200-mile link from Beijing to Shanghai. And then, what he didn't say, but what's clear, is that this could foreshadow use of high-speed magnetically levitated rail for what the Chinese generally call the New Silk Road, an aspect of the Eurasian land bridge linking China with Europe. Now, at the Germany conference May 4th through 6th in Bad Schwalbach, Russia's brilliant young economist Sergei Glazyev, the chairman of the Economic Committee of the Russian State Duma and the author of the book Genocide, published by EIR, responded from the podium to LaRouche's keynote address, as did another Russian economist, academician Menshikov. Following that conference session, Glazyev was interviewed in Bad Schwalbach by EIR's Rachel Douglas. Like his conference talk, the interview carried forward the dialogue of this leading Russian economist with Lyndon LaRouche. Let's turn now to that interview.
Rachel Douglas of EIR. We're here in Bad Schwalbach, Germany, at the conference of the Schiller Institute, where one of the keynote speakers was and is Dr. Sergei Glazyev of Russia. We're very pleased to have him here. Dr. Glazyev chairs the Economic Policy Committee of the State Duma of the Russian Federation. And last night spoke about not only the economic situation in Russia, but in the whole world, as he appeared on our keynote panel with Lyndon LaRouche. The name of our conference, Sergei Yurovich, is the Ecumenical Battle for the Common Good. And in your speech last night, you said that you thought this conference was particularly timely. Can you tell our listeners why you think so?
Well, yes, I think that this conference is a very important one, and it takes place just in time. Because at the moment when the world financial system is going through a turbulent crisis, which becomes deeper and deeper, you should think about what will be the possible way out from this crisis and what could be done in order to avoid the financial catastrophe together with economic catastrophe, which should split all over the world into the separate regions, and everybody will survive for himself. And here in this conference, we not only learned from worldwide experience what happens in different parts of the world in this very complicated and difficult situation, but also we elaborate on possible scenarios of overcoming the financial troubles and to switch to the worldwide development process, which will be based not on the financial bubbles and financial speculations in virtual economic activity, but which will be based on the improvement of the real life of the people in terms of growth of real production, of growth of GDP per capita, of improvement technologies, and increasing the quality of life.
Mr. LaRouche spoke about what he calls the Vernadsky strategy, and that the special role of Russia in this process can be based on its technological scientific traditions and the idea of great infrastructure projects in all Eurasia. How do others in Russia view the infrastructure proposal of the Schiller Institute and Mr. LaRouche on the Eurasian land bridge?
Well, I think that Russia really could and should play a very important role in the establishment of the new world architecture. And as far as we are speaking, not about the virtual economic activity, but about the real economic growth, we should think about the how the economic development could be promoted, not only in Russia or in other countries, but for the whole world, because at the moment the whole world financial system is going into trouble. And a lot of countries now lacking of capital, they couldn't find access to the capital market, they did not have credits to develop their infrastructure, to develop their products. And for this reason, in this conference, and especially in the works conducted by the Schiller Institute and Mr. LaRouche, we see a lot of very fruitful, to my mind, ideas concerning the promotion of the economic growth in the new economic situation.
Yeah.
And here I should say that one of this of those ideas, the establishment of large infrastructural projects, is one of the most actively discussed in Russia at the moment.
Right now.
We are speaking about the new stage of life of the Trans-Siberian Railroad, which could connect Far East with the Western Europe, with
and also the BAM, the famous Baikal-Amur.
Yes, Baikal-Amur mainline as a part of this Trans-Siberian corridor is finishing now. Maybe few people knows, but just few months ago, the last important tunnel was built, and at the moment we are ready to put this railroad into the full-scale operation. And it means that various goods could be delivered from Far East to Eastern Europe and vice versa in 2 weeks. Another very important infrastructure project which is considered in Russia at the moment is the modernization of the Northern Sea Route. The Northern Sea Route is another opportunity to connect Far East with the Western Europe. And it also took about 2 weeks by ship to get goods from Japan to, let's say, Netherlands.
And this is navigable at how many months during the year with the ice in the Arctic?
In fact, theoretically, it could be used all around the year using the modern nuclear icebreakers. But of course, usually it operates a half a year, starting from June or May and finishing in October, November. But any case, using the new technologies, constructing not only a nuclear icebreakers, but also opportunities to use underwater transportation and so forth, we can push the sea route to operate the whole year.
So there are many possibilities.
And yes, and finally, I should say that we should speak also not about the connections between Far East and Western Europe in Eurasia, but also we must think about how to improve communications between South and North. And here I'd like to say that also we already made some important decisions in Russia. For instance, we opened the air route through the northern polar. So now the airplanes from India could reach North America through northern polar.
Over the North Pole.
Which is about two times less distance than the usual one.
Right.
And I'm sure that this is the new air route will also be very important for the further economic development. Recently, during the visit of the Iran president to Russia, we agreed to open another very important communication and development channel from south to north, from Iran to through Caspian Sea and Volga River to the northern part of the Russia and to the Baltic Sea.
And I understand Iran has negotiated with, also with India on the completion of this north-south route.
Yes, and in this route you can use the already existed water channels which connect Caspian Sea with the Baltic Sea.
Yes.
And it makes easier and cheaply the transportation of the goods in large quantities.
Many people don't know.
Through this transnational routes.
You have the inland waterways in Russia have a very long history. Many people
from
don't
Peter
know
the Great.
Yes.
And we have the connections through river channels between all the seas in the European part of the Russia.
Right.
Black Sea, Caspian Sea, Baltic Sea, and Northern Ocean. So the development, the formation of these development corridors, which will be based on the modern transportation technologies, is very important device to stimulate economic growth and economic development.
Good.
But I'd like also to stress that in this conference, which is very important, we think about how to combine the competitive advantages of various countries in this very large region to push them into the mutually
beneficial
cooperation and how to combine efforts in order to achieve high rates of economic growth. And here, speaking about the Russian opportunities, as well as about opportunities of other countries, we could take together the comparative advantages with the new opportunities for economic growth. The point is that the economic growth is not even process. Each time you can see the growing industries and declining industries. You can see the emerging opportunities and closing this or that sectors of economic activity. And the theory of the long wave economic development, which is elaborated first by Russian scientist Kondratyev and then by a lot of followers all over the world, which established the long wave theory, gives a very good chance to forecast what will be the future locomotives of economic growth and concentrate the efforts of those countries in taking those opportunities together using the comparative advantage, trying to establish the locomotives for growth for the new long wave economic development period. And here, from Russian side, we can see such technologies as nuclear energy, natural gas recycling technologies, aviation, airspace, and so forth, those biotechnologies, those industries which are growing from 20 to 100% per year at the moment, and which really could give us new opportunities for growth.
New horizon.
The May 4th through 6th, Bajvalbach Conference, led by Lyndon LaRouche, which I've been discussing earlier, also featured the fight for the general welfare in the United States, the fight against the crisis caused by energy deregulation, the fight for the right to health care. One of the panels featured the leaders of the fight to save D.C. General Hospital in Washington. Nurse Charlene Gordon, the leader of the nurses at D.C. General, and Dr. Aleem Muhammad, the chairman of the Coalition to Save D.C. General Hospital. Let's go now to excerpts from the presentation of Charlene Gordon and that of Dr. Aleem Muhammad.
We say from our preamble, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, do ordain this Constitution of the United States, are all lies. When it comes to the poor, the uninsured, the underinsured, the indigent, the illiterate, the prisoners, the illegal aliens, and the mentally challenged, for they're not equal. If you're rich, you don't need insurance. If you have a health insurance, call an HMO, you have a copay that's called underinsured. Even though you're paying every month, don't go to the doctor for a sore arm because you got to up $15 just to see it. And if you don't have the $15, you don't see the doctor. Our standard of care in America is greed. We can never get enough money or real estate. The rich and the affluent have gotten that our country, or any country, was not built on or by their hands or the blood of their relatives. We the poor built America. You the poor built your country. And it is from your fathers and their fathers and you that their country is built through your strength and your sweat and tears. As long as we have KKK Katie Graham, the billionaires and owner of the Washington Post, and her little-minded followers in the FCC, which is called the Federal City Council, they're not federal. There is no city. It may be a council, though. But the present president, Bob Dole, he always wanted to be president. He got it. Mr. Matt Carkendale, owner of our two TV stations, Abe Poland, who owns the Wizards, no wonder they don't win a basketball game, and the owners of the Gannett newspaper, USA Today, and many more will always have to fight the system that favors the rich and the affluent. The fight has been in the makings for over 50 years to change D.C. General Hospital. Now, everything they have orchestrated in the 50 years have come together, and the demise of the 19 blocks from the capital of our country is being reconstructed, which is D.C. General. We are 1.9 miles from the capital, and they don't want us there anymore. Our mayor, Tony Williams, who was a foster child, nobody wanted him. Somebody picked that child up, loved him, gave him a family, and he has forgotten from hence where he came from. He wasn't nothing. He was poor. And he has forgotten his people. But what about our old lady, Eleanor Holmes Norton? She's turned her back on the same people who put her in this place. To be the delegate to speak for the general, she prefers to figure out what type of towels you put on Frederick Douglass' house than to save her people from dying in the streets when this comes to pass. D.C. General is 195 years old. It started off as an infirmary, and then eventually it became into a hospital that at one time housed 1,000 patients. We see over 170,000 people a year through our clinics and through the emergency room. 55,000 is coming directly from the emergency room. From that 55,000, 10,000 are inpatients every year. We have 15,000 ambulances rolling to us on a yearly basis. From that, you have 30 to 40% of those people who need inpatient care, and that's what they want to do. They want to get rid of inpatient care at DC General and make it into a big clinic or a little infirmary, whichever way you want to look at it. We have gone through a thing that's called a JACO. It's a joint accrediting commission for hospitals. It is done throughout the United States for every hospital throughout the United States. This year we scored 100%. Unfortunately, because the hospital has never been refurbished or rebuilt or renovated, they took 6 points away because the buildings are crumbling. But we still scored 94%. We are the highest in the district area. As far as that, John Hopkins cannot touch us. Washington Hospital Center, who has a 1,200-bed hospital, cannot touch us. But they want to close our safety net for our poor. They want the real estate on that ground. We have 124 acres of prime real estate, they tell me. Just buy some dirty water. I guess they'll clean it up, make a nice little harbor, put some condominiums up there, and clean everything behind it. They did it before in the past to different areas of the Washington District. They're moving all the poor and all the indigent away from the capital. They no longer want us there, yet we have been there for over 195 years. We can't find strong people to champion our cause that's right now that we're begging for. We lobby on a daily basis. We beg people to come and help us. The people who have helped us is the Schiller Institute. And I thank you for that. Because if it had not been for you, we wouldn't have gotten this far. There's a lady. Her name is Lynn Speed. She's the tiniest little thing you ever want to see. But good God, does she have energy. She never gives up. She pushes and she pushes and she doesn't know what stop is. And her husband follows right behind her. And that's him over there. They want to make you believe that DC General has the highest rate of cancer, diabetes, heart disease, lung disease, liver disease, kidney disease, accidents, and strokes. That's impossible. The district has the highest. But because these people cannot afford to go to another hospital, we are the safety net. They come to us. All the private institutions will not have that because they can't make any money from it. But our HIV is 9 times higher than the national average. Our homicide is 6.5, and we are a level one trauma. A level one trauma takes care of all gunshot wounds, all motor vehicle accidents, all stabbings, because we have all the doctors there. What happens when we're gone? The bloodshed of thousands of people will be on that ground, and our mayor will do nothing for it. Monday, our CEO, who came here to the hospital to close us down, saw something worthwhile about 8 months ago and decided he's not going to close us down. He decided to build us up and make us a better institution. But, of course, he didn't do what the mayor wanted, and Monday, the control board fired him. Well, I just found out they have given us all RIF letters. So, actually, there's nobody who will be working soon. So what the problem we have now is to get Congress to understand that the control board has used them. And they need to see that they have been subjugated just like the poor people have been subjugated. And Anthony Williams and Eleanor Holmes Norton and Catherine Graham all need to stop. Our safety net that is in our Constitution. The government doesn't want us to have it. They want a nice, beautiful harbor and possibly the Olympics in the year 2012. They see it coming with a nice little archery set by the water and people sitting down, I guess, drinking a little water, a little soda, chilling out while everybody else is dying around the streets and around them. What are we going to do? Well, we need to promote the general welfare, but not of the rich and famous. They already get it. We need to promote the welfare of the little people like us. And the only people who have been doing it is Dr. Muhammad, Dennis Speed, the people at DC General, but the Schiller Institute has been there throughout. Brotherhood, don't jump in that water. You may sink. Don't take a chance. And don't believe that there's created equality for all, because that's a grievous lie. They don't care about the little people. They don't care about the children we save. They don't care about the man who came in with a heart attack, and before he could get into the emergency room, well, we had taken care of it. And they don't care about that little baby who was born that I held her in my hand. And I watched a little infant who should have died be alive because of the nurses and the doctors at DC General. Mayor William wants you to think, well, what about all the other thousands of people? Well, what about all the other thousands of people? Why aren't they taken care of? Why aren't the private hospitals opening up to them, just like we open up to the thousands of uninsured patients? We take care of one-third of the 80,000 uninsured patients in the district. So I say to you, we have to fight with a pen and a paper, internet, flyers, broadsheet, media, if it's allowed, rally, boycotting, best by your mouth. You heard that thing that says if you want to get something sent from A to B, you do it by not telephone, television. You tell a woman, get on the line. Tell it to your mother. Tell it to any female you'll see, because she'll work. We've been working all our lives. It won't stop here. We will continue to work. We have to educate and explain and let them know that what is happening here is widespread, is forever reaching out. It's not just going to stop at DC General. It's going to hit your countries. It's going to close your hospitals. You cannot allow that to happen. It's your lives who are at stake and your children's lives who are at stake.
You're listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with the LaRouche Connection, produced by Executive Intelligence Review.
We have to hit Congress that the control board they appointed has turned on them too. We must stand up and be counted. No straddling of the fence. You're either with us or against us. You're our enemy or you're our friend. Remember this. If you stand for nothing, you will fall for everything. This is our country. This is our world. This is our world. It is time, folks, for you to take a stand and fight for what you believe in. Promote the welfare of this country. Do not let a man demote it. Thank you.
Very happy to be here. Very happy to have the opportunity to address this conference of the Schiller Institute. I'm happy to be back in Germany to see some of my friends and colleagues of some years ago. Very happy and honored to see Mr. LaRouche and Mrs. LaRouche and all of you who have come from your various homes, your nations, your cities, your communities, your families. And I feel especially blessed to have the opportunity to discuss something that exists perhaps in the microcosm. We're talking about a public hospital in a single city on this planet. And by discussing this little public hospital that represents in a certain way the microcosm, perhaps there are lessons that can be learned that apply to the macrocosm. I was trying to figure out how could I present something of a verbal headline, such as you might find written in a newspaper, that would instantly convey an idea, create perhaps a vision in the mind of what this is all about and why you should be concerned about it and why you should feel that it is important to you. Various notions came to me. I could title these remarks in many different ways. I could call it, for example, Frankenstein's Monster Bites Congress. I could have titled it Democracy or Genocide. I could have entitled it Resist the Devil and He Will Flee from You. Or I could have entitled it The Indispensable Victory. And I think although all of those titles and others could be useful, I think the last one is most important, The Indispensable Victory, because that conveys directly to you the importance that you and everyone should attach to the battle that is taking place in Washington, D.C. over the fate of the public's only hospital. Because this is a way for you and everyone throughout this world to measure what the world that we will soon inhabit in the near future, in the near-term future, is going to be like. Because if the battle for public health is lost in Washington, D.C., if the battle for the general welfare is lost in Washington, D.C. in 2001, then it's lost everywhere. And so it's an indispensable victory that must be had. The first time that I attended a Schiller conference here in Germany, some 10 or so years ago, is also the first time that I've met Helga LaRouche, and I had the opportunity to speak to Mr. LaRouche by telephone. At that time, of course, he was incarcerated. And I didn't know what to say to a man that is incarcerated. You know, I'm sorry. So I don't know how the conversation actually began, but he ended up saying something to me that has stayed with me all these many years. He explained it this way, very simply, that this is part of the price that you sometimes have to pay when you are fighting evil. Sometimes you go to prison, not because you're evil, not because you've done something wrong, but this is part of the price that you have to pay because of what you are doing in your fight against evil. And sometimes the battle doesn't go your way. Circumstances are not in your favor, and you pay a price. But the main thing is that you are fighting for what is right. And he told me that's what it's all about. And the thing to do is to have fun while you're doing it. That's what we're alive for. We're here to fight evil, to resist evil. And where I come from in Washington, D.C., it's not hard to find the evil. It's not hard to identify the devil. He's right there. That's where he lives. But victory in this case is indispensable. We cannot be content with saying that we're fighting the right fight, that we're standing up for right principles, and then call it a day. What Charlene was alluding to in her remarks is that this past Monday, this fight to save D.C. General Hospital suffered a loss. The Financial Control Board, which is the dictatorial body that I referred to as Frankenstein's monster, created by Congress to run the affairs of the district for the last 5 years, signed a contract to privatize the public hospital, to turn it over into the hands of a corporation that goes by the name Doctors Community Healthcare Corporation. Now, they're going to run what used to be the public hospital in Washington, D.C., even though they are based in Scottsdale, Arizona, more than 2,000 miles away. There are no doctors in Doctors Community Healthcare Corporation, and they are not a part of any known civilized community. This is a corporation that has the characteristics of not a higher predator, but one of the lower predators like hyenas and jackals who exist to sniff out those distressed hospitals that they can then move in on and take over, plunder, loot, and destroy. This is a criminal operation, not do-gooders who want to help the poor. These are organized criminals who are in the business of degrading the public health and private health of the American people. They are a part of an ongoing trend in the United States that has seen the destruction, the shutting down, if you will, of more than 1,500 public and private hospitals in the last 15 years, depriving the American people of the health infrastructure that was once the pride of the world, causing the American healthcare system, if you can actually apply the word system to it anymore, causing it to be rated by some who measure these things as 38th in the world, just one notch above Cuba. But of course, I've been to Cuba, and I think that's insulting to the Cubans, because they actually have a system in Cuba of healthcare. They actually have a system that is relatively competent and relatively compassionate towards the needs of all of their citizens. They actually have a doctor-patient ratio in Cuba that is much lower than the doctor-patient ratio in the United States. They actually have reversed certain scourges such as HIV and AIDS that, of course, continue to rage unabated in the United States. And so a rating system that says that the United States healthcare system is almost as good as the Cubans, or just a little better than the Cubans, is a flawed standard. But be that as it may, what we are witnessing in the United States is the degradation of health infrastructure, the reduction of the quality of life, and even the life expectancy. I come from Washington, D.C., where the life expectancy of a black male born in the District of Columbia is about the same as the life expectancy of, say, a man born in Sudan, or a man born in Ghana, or a man born in Uganda. Think about that. We have made these distinctions all afternoon about the developed world versus the underdeveloped world, or the undeveloped world, the first world, the second world, the third world. But in reality, there are parts of what we have called the developed world that have already been degraded. And the progress gained since the time of Roosevelt has already been lost. And so part of the victory is not only to stop the closing of D.C. General Hospital, but then after that ramp things back up and to redevelop and to rebuild and to reconstruct what has already been lost, and then move on from there. The issue for the dilemma for people who want to shut the hospital down, who want to privatize it, they really have some serious dilemmas, and that's what makes them such weak opponents ultimately. They have the appearance of strength, but actually they're very weak. And all that it takes is for ordinary men and women from the various walks of life to recognize what true strength is and what weakness looks like, and then be willing to take up a struggle on correct principles against that which is weak, against that which is evil. See what happened Monday night in Washington, or Monday in Washington, when the Financial Control Board signed the contract, illustrates perfectly what I'm talking about. The Financial Control Board, which is looked upon by most of the citizens of the District of Columbia as some all-powerful body that rules over Washington, D.C., and who can tell the mayor and the city council and everybody else what to do, actually demonstrates profound weakness. They wanted to sign a contract to privatize the public health in the district. They attempted to have a public signing ceremony, but the aroused citizens of the District of Columbia booed and hooted and verbally assaulted them, disrupting the proceeding so that after 5 minutes, the all-powerful Financial Control Board had to take flight. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. They took flight under police escort, finding refuge in the public hospital that they surrounded with SWAT-like police forces, the citizens banging at the doors, demanding to come in to stop this privatization of the public hospital. So the all-powerful Financial Control Board was forced into the basement of the public library in a back room under police guard, where they signed on a card table an illegal contract. Is that an image of strength and invincibility? Or is that the image of some scoundrels, criminals, who know that they are engaged in not only an unpopular action, but specifically an illegal one that is attempting to rob from the people that which is rightfully theirs? You see, because these would-be privateers, usurpers of the public welfare, have a tremendous problem on their hands, a tremendous dilemma. How do you convince free citizens in a democratic society to vote away that which belongs to them? How do you convince free men and women of reasonable intelligence that it would be better for them to sign their public hospital over into the hands of a private corporation in which they have no say? That's a tremendous problem to overcome. And ultimately, it can't be done. You must resort to the worst gangster tactics that you've ever seen in a grade B gangster movie. And that's exactly what was done in the District of Columbia. And so, as we speak here this afternoon, there's a contract that says that the public hospital of the District of Columbia is now owned by this private corporation. But you will not find on the contract the signature of a single public official. It's signed by a member of the control board, and it's signed by a member or an executive of this corporation. And ultimately, it shall not stand. And so we've suffered a loss, a battle loss, but if ultimately we win the war, then that's what's important. There's another dilemma that's looming. If the privatization goes forward, how does a for-profit corporation earn a profit on the backs of the poor? Well, it can't be done. The only way that you can earn a profit on the backs of the poor is to kill them by denying them services, denying them access, doing the things that would surely lead to the loss of life or of genocidal proportions. And how can that be done in the light of day? It can only be done in the darkness. It can only be done when there is a citizenry that is fast asleep. And so the movement that is evolving in Washington, D.C., ultimately makes what is being attempted in the privatization of the public hospital an impossibility. Because the citizens are no longer the Reverend James Bevel characterized them as being, like cattle on the back of a truck being driven to the slaughterhouse. No, that's what the citizens of Washington, D.C. were like some months ago. But as a result of the ongoing struggle, now some of them at least are standing up to be what they always were, which is citizens in a democratic republic who are informed of the issues, informed of their condition, and who are now developing the courage and the will to resist their would-be masters and their would-be controllers. So the movement to save DC General Hospital is a movement of profound importance, not only for the citizens of the District of Columbia, but for the entire nation and for the entire world, because it provides an opportunity that is not in the Great Lakes region of Africa, far from the view of most people. No, it is at ground zero in the so-called civilized world. It is in a place, it's taking place in a city that is at the center of the national life of America. It's in a city that is considered to be the international capital of the world. So it is an event that is taking place that cannot escape the notice of the entire population of the planet. And if in Washington, D.C., there is a transformation of an explosive type in the citizenry, so that they are no longer the cattle loaded on the back of a truck, but they are men and women who know that they are created in the image and likeness of their Creator, and who know that they are endowed with certain rights that are inalienable, and that they have a right to pursue those rights. And that they understand that although it may be a battle that will cause some suffering, if they are prepared to endure some suffering, then they are assured that in the end, they will have that indispensable victory. The transformative process is taking place not only on the level of the individual citizen. It's taking place on the level of the duly elected representative government of the District of Columbia. You may not know a lot about the history of Washington, D.C., but constitutionally, the District of Columbia is the responsibility of the U.S. Congress. And so the history of Washington, D.C. over the last two centuries or so has been cycles of more or less self-rule that then gets replaced with a more dictatorial process imposed by Congress. And so the five-year advent of the Financial Control Board is the last, is the latest installment of this kind of dictatorial rule imposed on the citizens of the District of Columbia. And so if you were a citizen in Washington, D.C., then you may be a little bit unsure of where you stand or what rights you have to rule yourself, because unlike the rest of America, there is no guarantee that you are to be represented in a democratic fashion. That's why it is important to understand that what is taking place, the privatization of public health, the denial of health care in the District of Columbia, can only take place as it is taking place because there is a little bit of confusion about democratic principles in that place. And so, therefore, there is a principle that is emerging that where democracy is being toyed with, where democracy is being degraded, where democracy is being denied, that leaves the room for genocide to come in. And so wherever you have the democratic opportunity that is being abused, then you have the possibility that all of the human rights that we hold dear are subject to challenge. So where democratic values can be strengthened, where people who aren't sure of what it means to be a citizen in a democratic republic, whenever they can be transformed, then you're seeing an example of how people protect their own self-interest for themselves, not relying upon others to do it for them. And so in this process of transformation of individual citizens, we've also seen the transformation of the democratic institutions that do exist within the District of Columbia. We've seen, for example, the city council, 13 elected representatives of the city on three separate occasions vote unanimously for the general welfare principle, voting to keep the hospital open, voting against the mayor's plan, voting for an appropriation of sufficient funds to continue the operation of the hospital to the end of the current fiscal year. And so what the Financial Control Board had to do in order to try to push their privatization scheme over on the resisting people was to resort to trickery. So instead of the usual 45-day review by the city council, because they knew that the contract would have been dead on arrival on the city council's desk, they sent it to the city council for your information only, not for your review. And then to add insult to injury, this monster created by the U.S. Congress turned around and bit the Congress itself by denying Congress the ability to review the contract that it has just signed with a criminal corporation from Arizona. Well, how did they do that? They called this an emergency measure. Well, the law is very clear. Emergency measure expires after 90 days, but this measure signed a contract that was to last for 5 years. If it's an emergency measure, there's no congressional review. If it's a normal contract, then it comes under congressional review. And there's a 30-day period of time given for that. And so now the stage is set. There are some who think that the battle has been lost, that the war has been lost. But no, the stage is now set because you have the democratic workings of a city council that is standing up for the general welfare principle. And now the challenge is to Congress. Will Congress recognize the decision of an unelected, undemocratic body, namely the Financial Control Board, over the clear decision of a democratically representative body, the City Council of Washington, D.C. If Congress, this is the part I like, if Congress refuses to see that their own legitimacy is being undermined by what the control board has done, then Congress itself is showing that it is unfit to govern a democratic people. So should watch. You should watch this issue very carefully. I think that with the proper ideas being given to Congress, they're a little sleepy. They just need to be awakened a little bit. But I think that ultimately Congress will respond to the challenge, and they will affirm that democratic ideals have primacy, that the general welfare principle has primacy over the private interests of any corporation, and that they, in fact, as duly elected representatives of a free people, are duty-bound themselves to uphold and reaffirm in every generation the general welfare clause of the Constitution. So I hope that those remarks help to bring into focus something that on one level is only a local issue, but on all other levels is of extreme relevance to every man, woman, and child who is alive today on this planet. Thank you.
You've been listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.